Well, thank you. Well, when I was asked to give a talk at this event, I first thought that I would simply give the Nobel Prize lecture as I'd given it in Stockholm. But then looking at the nature of the audience, I thought maybe that was not possibly the best option. And I did have a somewhat more informal version of the Nobel talk, which I gave in India a few years ago. And I thought perhaps that would be better tuned for this event. So this will be, some sense, halfway between a formal Nobel talk and the sort of informal reminiscences that you were hearing from the panel just before lunch. Okay. So if we go back to the early 60s, and let's try to go back. Yes, do I? Sorry, the next one. Yeah, here we are. Okay, most of you surely don't need this view graph, but let me just go through it very briefly so as to set the stage. According to the basic principles of quantum mechanics, as you all know, particles can be classified into fermions, which are very xenophobic, and bosons, which are very gregarious. And under appropriate conditions, bosons are so gregarious that they will display the phenomenon of Bose-Einstein condensation, or BEC. And what that means is that all the particles must behave in exactly the same way. As the cover of Science in, I think, 1996 showed, they behave exactly like a platoon of well-drilled soldiers. And that's true whether you're talking about a thermal equilibrium phenomenon or something which is more non-equilibrium. Now, the electrons in metals are fermions, so they can't undergo Bose condensation directly. However, two fermions make up one boson. So if the electrons can form pairs, a sort of, if you like, dielectronic molecules, then the pairs can undergo Bose condensation, and then they're predicted to show superconductivity. And that was the basic lesson of the BCS, Bardeen-Kubler-Schrieffer theory of superconductivity, formulated in 1957. To form these molecules, the electrons must experience an effective attraction, and indeed BCS, more earlier, Bardeen and Pines, had shown how they would do that, how they could do that. So that was one major event in condensed matter theory, which occurred in the late 50s. A second major development, which was actually slightly earlier in time, was the Landauer theory of a Fermi liquid, meaning a set of fermions with strong interactions. Possibly repulsive, maybe in some cases attractive. Now, according to the Landauer theory, basically the theory of a set of ordinary interacting fermions in the liquid state is not very different from that of a non-interacting gas. And so, if one looked at the subject of liquid helium-3, which by the late 50s had been the subject of experiment for maybe a decade or so, it looked as if the atoms of liquid helium-3 in the normal state were behaving according to the Landau-Fermi liquid theory. However, they had strong interactions, and part of those interactions were thought to be attractive. And therefore, the idea was vaguely floating around that maybe, like the electrons in a superconducting metal, two helium-3 atoms could form a so-called Cooper pair, in this case a diatomic molecule, and that would then show phenomena analogous to superconductivity. So that was the qualitative picture. In superconductors, the internal state of the pairs, the dielectronic molecules, is isotropic. The spins are opposed, and there is no relative rotation. So that's really rather boring. However, it was conjectured by a number of theoretical papers that in the Cooper-paired phase, hypothetical at that time, in that phase of helium-3, the Cooper pairs might form in an anisotropic state, with the spins possibly parallel and non-zero relative orbital angular momentum. And since the helium-3 atoms are electrically neutral, they couldn't be superconducting, but maybe they'll show the neutral analogue of that, namely superfluidity. So, I was coming to my own history on this. After I completed my doctorate with Dick Tahar in Oxford, partially on helium-3, I went to the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign as a postdoc with David Pines. And while there, it occurred to me that no one so far as I knew, had really put together the BCS theory of, which is a theory of the formation of Cooper pairs in a weakly interacting gas with attraction, put that together with the work of Landau on strong repulsive interactions. Now, since in the case of helium-3, you had both. You had a strong repulsive interaction, but also a weak attraction. And so I thought it would be interesting to see what happened if you tried to put together those two theories, which I tried to do. Now, in fact, when I looked at the literature, there had been one paper by Larkin and Migdal, which put together the two theories at zero temperature, but the results were pretty boring, really. Nothing was qualitatively changed from the simple BCS theory. However, there were experiments actually going on in the basement of the physics building at Illinois by John Wheatley on liquid helium-3. And he was looking for the superfluid transition. And therefore, I thought it would be interesting to just see, or it might be interesting to see what happened if you put together the Landau and BCS theories at non-zero temperature. And when I started this program, I anticipated the result was going to be rather boring. I thought that just as at zero temperature, all that would happen is that everything was just multiplied by some kind of overall constant and so forth. So that really wasn't much fun. However, I decided to do the calculation anyway. And what I found after I'd been through a whole lot of Green's functions and so on and so forth, I found that things were much more interesting. It looked as if the temperature dependence of the various quantities, and in particular of the spin susceptibility and normal density, that was different from what was predicted by the simple BCS theory. So that really triggered my interest. I didn't like having just gone through a whole lot of Green's functions to get this result. So I decided to try to see it in a more phenomenological way, and eventually I managed to reformulate the theory in terms of a set of generalized molecular fields, analogous to the Weiss field in ferromagnets. And then it really came out beautifully. You could see exactly what was going on. You could see that indeed the temperature dependence of the spin susceptibility and also of the normal density was different in an interesting way from the simple predictions of the BCS theory. And this is really a fillip to me. I thought, now I've really done something. I was able to give a talk at an international conference on it, and it got some attention and so on and so forth. In retrospect, I think it's it was very fortunate that I didn't know something at that point. What I didn't know was that, in fact, a month or two before my own paper was published, there had been another paper in the Russian literature which had basically got these results, but they got them all dressed up in Green's functions and so on and so forth, and it seemed they didn't really know that they got something which was interestingly different from BCS theory. So I think had I known that I'd been anticipated, It might have been a big damper on my enthusiasm. I'd have probably never gone to the stage of getting a phenomenological picture. I might even not have continued in academic physics, I think. So that was the first serendipity in my career. Following that, I decided that, yes, you know, I probably should go and try to go forward in academic physics. And I spent a second postdoc in the group of Professor Takeya Matsubara in Kyoto. And I worked on various things, but one of the things I worked on was two-band superconductors. There had been an experiment which appeared to show that niobium was the two-band superconductor. That's a superconductor where the Fermi surface intersects two different bands. And it turns out that in that situation you get various interesting phenomena. In particular, you get a sort of sloshing of the Cooper pairs between the two bands, and I worked out the theory of that. Well, unfortunately, no sooner had I sent off my paper on this topic for publication than a second experiment was done on niobium, and it turned out it wasn't a two-band superconductor after all. So I thought, well, that was a bit of a waste of time. But when I did write it up, to the extent of actually publishing a paper, and put the calculations away in a drawer and forgot about them, basically. After a couple of these two postdoc years and a third sort of peripatetic postdoc year, when I worked at various places, I ended up at Sussex, the University of Sussex in the UK, in 1967, and I worked on various topics in low-temperature physics, including normal liquid helium-3. And in that context, I had some contact with Bob Richardson at Cornell University, but this was on some peculiar nuclear magnetic resonance properties of normal superfluid helium-3, where his group had done the experiment and I had done the theory, neither of us knowing about the other, and then we put them together and found that they jibed exactly. So that was rather satisfying. But after a few years at Sussex working on standard low-temperature physics, I began to get seduced by the foundations of quantum mechanics. And by the summer of 1972, I'd really made up my mind to quit doing standard low-temperature physics and devote my research time entirely to the foundations of quantum mechanics. Incidentally, I was lucky to be where I was. I was at a British university in the late 60s, early 70s, I had tenure. I could just do this and forget about publishing papers in Science and Nature, etc., etc. So another piece of luck. So I was just about to set out in this new direction in the early summer of 1972. And then two things happened which really were very serendipitous. The first thing was that Bob Richardson and his wife came across to the UK and went around visiting various places. And one of the places that they decided to visit was Sussex. Now, what is ironical was that they said this visit to Sussex had nothing to do with physics. It was because Bob's wife, Betty, was a great friend of the wife of one of my colleagues at Sussex. So she decided to pay a social visit to her, and Bob came along for the ride, as it were. And Bob went along for the ride, and while he was there, of course, wanted to talk a bit of physics. But I was not there at the time. I was in Scotland. I was intending to be in Scotland on a climbing holiday. For some obscure reason, which certainly slips my memory at this time, I had to make a phone call back to Sussex. Nothing about physics, it was just some kind of minor administrative problem. And when I made this phone call back from Scotland, I mean, normally I wouldn't have tried to call. You know, it's not that easy in the remote highlands of Scotland to make a phone call back. And there were no cell phones in those days. But I did make this phone call back, and whoever answered the phone mentioned to me that Bob Richardson was about to visit Sussex, I think the next day or a couple of days' time, and if I were around, would like to talk to me. And that he had some new results he'd like to show to me. And I thought with myself, shall I go back? I mean, I wanted to talk to Bob. I'd already knew him, as I said. But I was also having a very good time rock climbing in the Highlands. I think on the day in question, the weather made up my mind for me. I think it rained, as it so often does in Scotland, and so I decided that I would go back and talk to Bob. And in retrospect, what I did and what Bob told me that day essentially permanently changed my whole career in physics. So what was it that he told me? Well, if we think about a typical nuclear magnetic resonance experiment, you have a constant magnetic field along the vertical axis, say, and if you tip a spin, say a nuclear spin, away from that axis, it will precess around the axis of the magnetic field. And the rate of precession is given by a quantity called the gyromagnetic ratio times the field. Now, in the case of helium-3, gamma is known and is about 3 kHz per Gauss. So the rate of precession then will measure the magnetic field, H, which the spin is feeling. And to measure the precession frequency, what you do is you apply an RF field perpendicular to the external one, and when you actually hit, when the frequency of the oscillating field hits the precession frequency, you'll get a strong absorption. It's very standard stuff. Now, the Cornell group, led by Bob, had done nuclear magnetic resonance in liquid helium-3 below 3 millikA, and they found something rather surprising. In the normal phase, they found that the precession frequency was just equal to gamma times the external field. So no problem, no problem whatever, just textbook. When they went below a certain temperature into what we now call the A phase of liquid helium-3, the resonance frequency started shifting up above the so-called Larmor frequency, the normal phase value. And it seemed to shift according to a quadratic formula, like which is in red at the bottom of the screen here. Does this work? This formula here. Then when you go to a second phase, these phases incidentally had been previously identified by thermodynamic data, the two phase transitions. When you made the second phase transition into the so-called B phase, the resonance frequency just dropped back to the normal state value. So what was going on here? A lot of people have thought about some of the phenomena which helium-3, if it really did form Cooper pairs, various phenomena it might show, but no one had ever thought that the nuclear magnetic resonance might be interesting enough to think about. So it was, basically that was a fresh field. And then there was another bit of a serendipity which came in. It turned out that in facing this problem, I knew what I needed to know. That is, I knew a good deal of the theory of normal helium-3. I'd actually worked on that. And moreover, I knew some of the predictions which theorists had made about the possible superfluid phase. However, much more importantly in a way, I think, I did not know what I needed not to know. What do I mean by that? Well, at the time we're talking about, 1972, there was a vast amount of literature on nuclear magnetic resonance, including a very good book by my later colleague, Charlie Slichter, at the University of Illinois. And I simply said to myself, I am not going to read that existing literature, because this phenomenon is so weird that it doesn't look like anything which is in the books, as it were. And therefore, in some sense, the books can't be relevant. So I will just start to think about this from scratch. And I did. So the way I basically thought about it was something like this. In the A phase, the precession frequency is larger than the value in the normal phase, and is given by this so-called Pythagorean expression, this one here. That was the experimental result, nothing to do with theory. The simplest interpretation of that is that there is a somehow generated an extra field which is added to the external field. So now you get a total field which is, which is this one here, which indeed is given by a Pythagorean type of formula, exactly as we needed it. And then the nuclear spins are going to precess around this they're going to precess around this total field, and therefore the precession frequency should be given by this formula here. Well, that was fine until I came to put in the orders, the actual quantitative considerations. And I found that the only possible origin of this extra internal field was the other nuclear spins. But the other nuclear spins are very tiny. And even if you pack them all together, 30 of them, say, around the spin in question, you only get a field of the order of about a Gauss or less, whereas experimentally, this field internal here, H internal, that field has to be of the order of 30 Gauss. This was so extraordinary, or seemed to me at the time so extraordinary, that I actually began seriously to wonder whether it might be the first evidence that quantum mechanics broke down under these extreme conditions. After all, you had a very dense system, very, very quantum mechanical, at temperatures to which essentially no one had ever gone before. Could it be that something was suddenly beginning to fail in that? So anyway, I decided that rather than veer off in my research into the foundations of quantum mechanics, I should first make sure that quantum mechanics was actually working in this very concrete experimental problem. That's what I tried to do. So my first thought was to try to construct explicitly a proof that if I applied standard quantum mechanics and I applied standard statistical mechanics, then this phenomenon, the experimental frequency shift, simply could not occur. That's what I set out to do. Well, of course, it didn't quite work out that way, or you'd have heard about it by now. What it turned out, using rather straightforward summary arguments, was that, first of all, the simple classical argument was too naive, and secondly, that if you did a proper analysis of the sum rules, then you did indeed predict a Pythagorean formula where the square of the internal field, I called it something else previously, but it's this one here, the square of that field is proportional to the average value of the nuclear dipole interaction energy. Now, what does that imply? That implies that given the experimental value of the frequency shift, the expectation value, the average value of the nuclear dipole-dipole interaction energy had to be of the order of 10 to the minus 3 ergs per centimeter cubed, which doesn't sound very large, but there's a problem. If I take two small magnets and try to place them, suppose I have them parallel, and I try to place them like this, then, as you might know, some of you from your laboratory experience, they don't like it. They prefer to sit like this, end to end, not side by side. But what's the energy difference between them? Well, It's a very simple matter of classical classical theory of magnetism. The difference in energy between these two orientations, the good one and the bad one, is something like it's the nuclear moment squared divided by r cubed, etc., etc. That comes out to about 10 to the minus 7 degrees K per pair. And that's even if they're at the closest separation. But the thermal energy at the temperatures we're talking about, which is about a millidegree, that's about 10 to the minus 3 K. So that should mean that the preference for the good orientation over the bad one is only a factor of about 10 to the minus 4. And that was simply nowhere near enough to explain the experimental frequency shift. What we need is a preference for the good orientation over the bad one, which is not of order the thermal energy, the nuclear dipole energy divided by the thermal energy, but much greater than that, something of order 1. Okay? In other words, for some reason or other, all the pairs of nuclear spins had to be sitting like that, or rotating like that, say, not like that. And that really caused me a lot of sleepless nights in June of 1972. Finally, I did come up with a possible solution. This is based on the analogy with ordinary ferromagnetism, and I call it the spontaneously broken spin orbit symmetry, or SBSOS for short. It works like this. If we think about an ordinary Heisenberg ferromagnet, then you have apply an external field in this direction. Each individual spin can either have a good orientation or a bad one. In the paramagnetic phase, the spins depend more or less independently. So this tendency for good over bad competes with the thermal energy, and it's that is much less than one. But below TC, something peculiar happens. The strong exchange forces, which have nothing to do with the Zeeman effect, strong ferromagnetic forces constrain all the spins to be parallel. So now you have competition, not between a single spin being up or down, but between either all the spins being up and all of them being down. And the difference between those two configurations, the difference in Zeeman energy, is the single spin energy multiplied by the total number of spins. And n is typically of the order of 10 to the 23. That means that result is much greater than 1, and therefore you get more or less complete polarization along the magnetic field. That's been well understood for many decades. In the case of liquid helium-3, you get something similar happen. The difference in energy per pair is only this 10 to the minus 7 K. In the normal phase, the pairs behave independently, so this thermal energy competes with the this very small interaction energy, which competes with the thermal energy, and that means that the tendency for good over bad is only very tiny. The degree of polarization, again, is only very tiny. However, in the A phase, if we assume that for some reason associated with the strong forces, nothing to do with the dipole forces, so something like kinetic energy and van der Waals and so forth, if that constrains all the pairs to behave in the same way, then either all the pairs must behave in a good way or they must all behave in a bad way. And then the competition is not with the single spin energy difference, but with that multiplied by n, again, n something of the order of 10 to the 23. That means the tendency to good over bad can be of order 1. In other words, you're going to find all the spins either doing this or doing this. And they do, in fact, all prefer to do that. So that's what we're going to do. So one could work, I won't go further into that, into the detailed theory. I did, in fact, eventually have to produce a microscopic theory of the spin dynamics in helium-3. And that was another bit of serendipity. It turned out that my Kyoto work on two-band superconductors came back to help me. And my theory of the theory I eventually evolved of NMR in superfluid helium-3 is basically a generalization of that old and apparently useless work. I was able to make various other predictions, for example, about nuclear magnetic resonance with the RF field polarized along the external field. I predicted a resonance to occur there. Sure enough, it did when the experiment was done. So in the end, I think most people agree that this is the right way of looking at things. Well, rather than use up the remaining, whatever it is, 2 or 3 minutes on telling you more about helium-3, I would like just to make a few remarks. I've often been told that in this kind of talk, I should offer some sage advice to the younger generation. Well, I don't want to be sage, but at least I'll try to offer some advice. So, I mean, this is a question I often get asked when I give this kind of talk. So the first piece of advice I think I would give is, whatever else you do, try to follow your own curiosity. And if you don't understand how something works, as it were, follow it up, spend time on it. Don't worry if everyone around says, oh, that's a silly question. Everyone knows how that works, as it were. If you don't understand it, follow it up. In this context, I always think of Einstein. For 250 years before Einstein, ever since Galileo, people had known that if you dropped some object in vacuum, whether it was a feather or a stone or who knows what, it would always fall with the same gravitational acceleration. Einstein asked why. And I'm sure a lot of his colleagues said, yeah, that's a stupid question. Everyone knows, they just do. Right? But he followed it up. By doing so, he produced the theory of general relativity, which to my mind is the most beautiful theory in modern physics. That's point one. Point two, don't worry too much if the problem that you're looking at has been addressed in the existing literature. Much better to go ahead and think about it from scratch yourself. Of course, once you've eventually solved it, then you go and look in the literature and find out whether anyone else has come up with the same solution. If they have, don't worry, because almost certainly you did it a slightly different way, you will learn something from it. And thirdly, don't think any research is ever wasted if it's been done conscientiously and honestly. Put it away in a drawer, 15 years' time, it'll come back and help you, as it did with me. The work in Kyoto helped me in the NMR later. Fourthly, always go for simple pictures if you possibly can. If you find something using some terribly elegant and complicated functional integral or Green's function, whatever approach, don't be satisfied with that. Try to see if there is some simple picture which comes out of that. I mean, the Russians, basically, when I was working on combining BCS and Landau in 1965, the Russians had done it, because they hadn't realised what they'd done, basically, because they didn't have a simple physical picture. And that's what came out of a different way of thinking about it. And finally, very important, I think, piece of advice, assuming that most of you are going to be going on into some kind of academia, either high school or university, rather than going, say, into business, your work, your career will consist of course, an ingredient of pure research, but also an ingredient of teaching. Take your teaching at least as seriously as you take your research. That will be not only good for your students, it'll also be good for you and your research. I feel that probably more than 50% of the important ideas which I've been able to try to look at during my own research have either directly or indirectly evolved out of teaching, and often just teaching undergraduate courses, not particularly sophisticated one. So above all else, remember that as an academic, you're not just a researcher, you're also a teacher. Thank you.
Beautiful. So, and we are well under time, so we have time for questions. Don't be shy.
You mentioned this tension that the critical model may between, you know, working on this low temperature and foundation of quantum mechanics. So were you disappointed that quantum mechanics doesn't have to be changed?
Yes. Yes, it would have been far more exciting had I found out that quantum mechanics had broken down, but alas, as you know, it hasn't. But I'm still pursuing, in some sense, that line of research, but now in a rather different direction. I've been trying to encourage experiments on how far the predictions of quantum mechanics not only remain true, but the extent to which experiments are incompatible with a non-quantum mechanical picture. I've been trying to pursue that in the direction of macroscopic objects, like, say, flux qubits and things like that. And I think we've made some progress in that direction, but alas, quantum mechanics works okay.
Lohan, can you throw two seats back? There you go.
Thank you for being here today. I'm going to ask a non-scientific question, but it's tangentially related to science. Who are your heroes in the scientific community?
Well, if you ask on the purely within the purely scientific context, without referring, say, to personalities and so forth, then most certainly Isaac Newton, because I really think he was the greatest physicist of all time. Even Einstein can't quite compete, I think, with Newton. In more modern times, I would go, for example, I think mostly for Lev Landau. He's been a great influence on my own thinking. He loved to make simple phenomenological models of really complex, apparent at first sight, really complex situations, and in many cases succeeded. For example, both his work on liquid helium-4 and his Fermi liquid work on helium-3. There are a number of contemporary experimentalists for whom I have great admiration. I probably shouldn't mention names, that would be too discriminatory. But I do feel that a lot of experimentalists are doing very good work. And moreover, I should say, by and large, over my career, I've found that the experimental low-temperature physics community is more open to novel suggestions than most of the theorists. When I started working seriously on this attempt to push quantum mechanics towards the macroscopic level, we got a lot of flak from the then so-called quantum measurement communities. This whole group of people who spent their whole lives proving that quantum mechanical effects all had to go away at the macroscopic level, so they didn't like at all what I and others were doing there. But the experimentalists were much more open-minded, and they went ahead and did the experiments, and sure enough, they came out with meaningful results.
We can ask more questions during the panel. If there are no more questions, then let's thank Anthony once more.